This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Today, a federal judge in West Virginia issued a ruling that's another blow to the controversial mining practice known as mountaintop removal. That's where coal companies blast away tons of rock and dirt and dump the waste into valleys and streams. The ruling blocks the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers from issuing so-called nationwide permits, and it requires more detailed plans for each individual mine. Scott Finn of West Virginia Public Broadcasting reports on the bitter fight over mountaintop removal.
Blair, West Virginia is literally at the center of the debate over mountaintop removal. Disabled coal miner Alex Tomlin blames the mines for poisoning his well. So he drives to one of the area's few remaining natural springs to collect drinking water.
This water is perfect water. It takes it approximately 3 years to filter down through the soil to come out right here.
Tomlin dips his cup into the small pool of water where you can see a yellow salamander and a crawdad as big as a man's thumb.
And taste it and see if you can't taste good water.
Dozens of families used to live in Blair. Now just a few are left. Another mountaintop removal mine is expanding into this area, and when it does, Tomlin expects the water here to go bad too. Water is at the heart of a recent EPA challenge of two proposed mining permits, one just a few miles from Blair. This sort of questioning was unheard of during the Bush administration. In two letters, the EPA says it has serious concerns about the cumulative effect of so much mining.
These letters are not the end of mountaintop removal mining. We hope they're the first step.
That's Joe Lovett, director of the Appalachian Center for the Economy and the Environment. He's been fighting mountaintop removal in the courts for more than a decade. He says the practice violates the Federal Clean Water Act because it unleashes a slew of pollutants and has buried hundreds of streams altogether.
We're losing forever now more than 2,000 miles of mountain streams in this region. There is no practice in this country that's as environmentally destructive as large-scale surface mining.
In these new EPA letters, Lovett sees a real shift in federal policy. That's probably the only thing that Lovett and Steve Walker agree upon. Walker's business sells and services mine equipment and employs about 800 people. On the wall, he displays a 2002 photo of when President Bush visited his shop. Walker says coal production is already down because of the recession, and now there's this new scrutiny from the Obama administration.
It's just the EPA, for some reason, they've only been there for, 6 weeks? And all of a sudden they become smarter than everybody else. So you've got to suspect that somebody up there is wanting to do away with coal.
The EPA denies that and even said it anticipates the bulk of the permits will be approved. But in an interview with the Louisville Courier-Journal last week, the president himself called the environmental consequences of mine runoff horrendous. Talk like that worries surface miners like Roger Horton. He makes $74,000 a year, a small fortune for Logan County, and he started a group called Citizens for Coal.
Everyone was scared absolutely to death. And we all got to talking and all got together and we started calling our congressmen, our senators, and wanting some type of answer. And it's been nothing but absolute turmoil. And still, I still don't understand what they're doing.
From the front porch of his new three-story house, he can see the interstate highway, built with the same methods as a mountaintop removal mine. Opponents of mountaintop removal say curbing the practice would actually create more jobs for underground miners. It's a theory that may be tested in the near future. For NPR News, I'm Scott Finn in Charleston, West Virginia.
South Florida has a problem with invasive animals. Iguanas, lionfish, Gambian pouch rats, the list is long. At the top of that list is the Burmese python, and Congress is now considering banning their importation and their sale. From Miami, NPR's Greg Allen reports for Python Duty.
It's a beautiful spring day on Big Pine Key, and what better way to spend it than wrangling Burmese pythons.
And remember, as you're approaching it, they can turn around real quick and strike at some distance. So it's always a good idea to approach from behind the animal.
Ron Rosar of the U.S. Geological Survey and Jeff Fobb of Miami-Dade Fire Rescue are teaching state and federal wildlife officials a skill that's increasingly in demand in South Florida, catching pythons and other large exotic snakes. Jill Isaac with Florida's Fish and Wildlife Commission dons heavy gloves and warily approaches the snake. an 8-foot long Burmese python.
And so you just grab his
Grab him. Yeah, you got big old gloves on. Tell me if the teeth go through.
This is not fun.
Here.
He's facing me.
There you go.
Isaac grabs the snake by the head and midsection and lifts him up triumphantly. Burmese pythons like this one have become commonplace in South Florida in recent years. They were first seen in Everglades National Park in the 1990s, and since then they've grown as a threat to native wildlife. Rangers and tourists in Everglades National Park have watched epic struggles between pythons and alligators in the park. Art Roybal of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says a few years after they were first sighted, Burmese pythons have become firmly established there.
The first breeding population, an actual nest of eggs with a female wrapped around those eggs, was found in 2006. It was a matter of males finding females and vice versa, and now they're breeding out in Everglades National Park.
Last year, biologists removed 300 Burmese pythons from the park. The concern now is that pythons born in the wild are spreading from the park to other areas, such as the Florida Keys. Allison Higgins of the Nature Conservancy says the first Burmese python was found on Key Largo, the island closest to the mainland, in 2007.
You know, the first one showed up. Some people thought it was a pet. Somebody thought it was the Burmese. It wasn't until six more showed up within 2 months of each other we realized, oh yeah, this probably isn't pets.
Higgins and the Nature Conservancy have taken the lead in an effort to protect the Keys and the endangered species that live there from invading pythons. It's called the Python Patrol. Higgins has enlisted mail carriers, utility company employees, and now the public, asking them to call a special hotline when they spot a large snake. To stop the threat of Burmese pythons and other exotic species, two bills are currently being considered in Congress. One would require the government to evaluate all species proposed for importation and put the burden on the importer to show they aren't harmful. Another singles out pythons and puts an immediate halt to their import and interstate trade. Andrew Wyatt is the president of the U.S. Association of Reptile Keepers, which opposes both proposed laws.
The whole thing about somehow that these are escaped or released pets is just ridiculous.
Wyatt says it's the wild python population now firmly established in the Everglades that's the problem. The proposed legislation does nothing about that population, instead targeting what he says is a $1 billion-a-year reptile and amphibian industry. Wildlife groups and government agencies hope an active python patrol will contain the population in the Everglades and prevent them from spreading south through the Keys and north through Florida. Meanwhile, they're beginning to focus on another large invasive reptile that's been found breeding in Florida. It's the Nile monitor, a lizard that's a fast runner, a voracious predator, and one that can grow up to 7 feet in length. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Next, we have another installment in our series, Sounds Wild. The series takes us today to the African nation of Gabon, and that's where we'll hear the mating songs of hammer-headed bats. Apparently, a male's ability to sing has a lot to do with his chances of finding a mate, since his larynx takes up over half his body. The man listening with us is Jack Bradbury of the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology.
I'm sitting in the dugout canoe, and you hear in the background the river ibis, which are flying down the river, making their loud noise. And then a couple of the bats, the males, have flown across the river. They're now hanging from the trees by their feet, and they're starting to flap their wings fairly feebly, and they're starting to warm up their call, this loud, metallic honk, honk, honk. Other males come in and fly up close to a male who's calling, and he then makes that raspy, aggressive sound. And occasionally one will come up and knock the calling guy off his perch and take over his perch. They've really warmed up now. It's maybe about 6:30, quarter to 7. They're all calling at sort of a steady rate and waiting for some females to show up. Now, a female has come to the lek. She flies up and hovers in front of a particular male whose call appealed to her, and then he speeds up and does this staccato buzz. He pulls his wings in close to his body and makes a very, very loud and very rapid buzzing sound. Gradually, she whittles her choice down to two or three, and finally she goes back to one and makes him do it several times. And then she lands next to him, There's silence. They mate. It takes 20, 30 seconds. And then she always gives this call, this release call, which says, I'm through. Let me go. And then she takes off. The way in which he performs the display, how well he does it, it's like doing a dance step. How well he does it determines whether the female wants to mate with him.
The sounds for our series, Sounds Wild, come from the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology, and NPR's Christopher Joyce helped track them down. To see the hammer-headed bat yourself, visit us at NPR.org.
Economic realities have intruded on Florida's efforts to save the Everglades. Environmentalists were thrilled last year when the state announced a deal to buy out one of the region's largest landholders, U.S. Sugar. It was a huge deal with a huge price tag, but today Florida's governor said the recession has forced him to downsize that deal by more than half. From Miami, NPR's Greg Allen reports.
Even after the downsizing, it's still the largest land conservation deal in Florida's history, an area about twice the size of Orlando. The original deal was far larger, 180,000 acres of land plus all of U.S. Sugar's plants and facilities for $1.75 billion. But it was announced at a critical time, shortly before the economy and the stock market went into free fall.
You know, nothing worthwhile in life is easy. This has not been easy.
At a news conference in Tallahassee today, Governor Charlie Crist said the challenging economic conditions forced Florida and U.S. Sugar to rethink the original deal. As the economy turned down, a tight credit market and rising interest rates made financing more difficult than anticipated. In addition, falling home values led to a steep drop in property tax collections, a key revenue source for the state agency charged with acquiring the land. Under new terms worked out with U.S. Sugar, the state will now acquire more than 70,000 acres of land for $530 million. Florida will also retain an option to buy U.S. Sugar's remaining land holdings for 10 years. Crist says that gives Florida the ability to wait until the economy turns around before buying the remaining 107,000 acres.
The point is to connect the lake, Lake Okeechobee, with Florida Bay and restore the natural flow. And this has been a dream of many for a long time before I got here.
It's a dream, though, that will now have to wait a few more years, at least until the economy improves. In the meantime, there are other benefits to the new, smaller deal. An important one for U.S. Sugar workers and residents of the nearby town of Clewiston is that it preserves an estimated 1,700 jobs. For at least the next decade, U.S. Sugar Vice President Robert Coker says the company will keep running its sugar mill and refinery.
U.S. Sugar will be able to continue to operate with some economic certainty, which will help our employees and help our local community leaders understand that our company is going to continue to be in existence and provide good economic jobs for our communities.
Despite the downsizing, environmental groups are still pleased with the deal and with Governor Crist, a moderate Republican who's consistently taken strong positions on environmental issues. Today, Crist called the Everglades a special place that Floridians have a duty to protect. The problem with the Everglades is that decades of development and agriculture have diverted much of its water. And the water that does flow south now contains pollutants that harm the fragile ecosystem. Kirk Fordham, head of the Everglades Foundation, says the 70,000 acres being acquired by the state will help address both issues, water flow and water quality in the Everglades. And he says he's not troubled by the deal's downsizing.
Everglades restoration was always intended to be conducted in phases, and even if they had acquired all of the land tomorrow, they couldn't possibly begin constructing projects on all of that land.
Fordham is confident the state will buy more land from U.S. Sugar as the economy improves. Everglades restoration, he says, depends on it. After this acquisition, he says his foundation estimates at least 50,000 additional acres will be needed to begin the long process of restoring the flow and water quality of Florida's River of Grass. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Mountaintop mining permits are only one of many Bush administration policies that President Obama's environment team has been rethinking. For 8 years, the Bush administration downplayed the threat of climate change and pursued a pro-business strategy on air and water pollution, endangered species, and pesticides. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren joins us to talk about a few of the policies the Obama team is redoing. And Elizabeth, let's start with a policy about climate change. There was a finding sent by the new head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Lisa Jackson, a finding sent to the White House saying that climate change is endangering the American public's health and welfare, a real turnaround from the Bush administration. What are the ramifications of that? What could happen?
Well, this came from a Supreme Court ruling 2 years ago. It rejected the Bush administration's argument that the EPA doesn't have the power to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. Interestingly, arguing against the Bush administration in that case was a Georgetown law professor, Lisa Heinzerling. She's now EPA's top lawyer. Now, if the EPA goes ahead as we expect and says that greenhouse gas emissions are endangering public health, that sets up a requirement that EPA regulate those emissions. Now, the White House has said that that's not their preferred way to go. They want Congress to decide how to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. But if Congress can't manage to do it, which is a possibility, then this gives EPA the power to go ahead.
And what's the response from industry to that?
Well, industry hates the idea of the EPA going ahead and doing its own regulation. It has all kinds of fears that these regulations would regulate just about every tiny little business that there is out there. Now, environmentalists say that EPA would not be that aggressive, but we'll have to wait and see.
Now, the Bush administration blocked an effort by California and some other states to cut greenhouse gas pollution from cars. Now the EPA is reconsidering that. What's expected to happen there?
Well, environmentalists expect that the EPA will give California the waiver that will allow California and several other states, many other states, to go ahead and regulate greenhouse gas emissions. It's not completely clear yet what the EPA will do. The new chief, Lisa Jackson, did go ahead and reevaluate this very quickly. But automakers are saying that this is not the time to make their job even harder.
Lisa Jackson has said she's doing a broad review of thousands of Bush administration policies. What other kinds of initiatives might be overturned in this administration?
Well, there are tons of possibilities. One of the Bush administration policies made it easier for dirty coal-fired power plants not to clean up by putting on pollution controls. That one might be targeted by the new administration. Another gave pesticide companies the right to use human subjects in their testing. That one might be targeted. And there are lots of others that deal with whether or not to regulate perchlorate, that's rocket fuel, from drinking water, and whether they would regulate the mercury emissions that come from coal-fired power plants.
It's not just EPA at work here trying to reverse environmental policies. The Interior Department is involved as well. What are they doing?
Well, there are a few things that have happened so far. The new Interior Secretary, who is Ken Salazar, canceled some controversial leases for oil and gas drilling in Utah. Those leases involved parcels that are near some national parks like Canyonlands and Arches. He also decided to go slow on a policy that would increase oil and gas drilling offshore, off of the coast of California and the East Coast and the far eastern Gulf of Mexico. And President Obama himself stepped in and decided that he wanted to block, at least temporarily, a Bush administration policy that would weaken the power that wildlife experts have to prevent government actions that could harm endangered species.
Sounds like a lot of stuff in here that environmentalists would like, business interests would not like. Any exceptions to that?
There is an exception. Ken Salazar, the new Interior Chief, did affirm a Bush administration policy that takes the gray wolf off the endangered species list, both in the Great Lakes states and in the northern Rocky Mountain states, all except for Wyoming. And wildlife advocates were very upset with this decision.
NPR's national environment correspondent Elizabeth Shogren, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Today, the U.S. government took a major step toward curbing pollution from ships. Emissions from ocean-going ships kill tens of thousands of people around the world each year. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports.
The Environmental Protection Agency and the Coast Guard asked the International Maritime Organization to require that ships traveling within 230 miles of U.S. coasts use cleaner fuel. They want to cut sulfur in the fuel by 98% and strip out other pollution. EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson says the cleanup is long overdue.
It will make a huge difference in air quality. Our studies show that air quality in places as far away as Kansas will benefit from this being done on the West Coast ports in California.
The cleanup will come in stages, but Jackson says by 2020 the impact will be dramatic.
The estimates are over 8,000 lives saved and literally millions of people whose health will be improved by our proposal today.
James Weinbrake is a professor of public policy at Rochester Institute of Technology in New York. He co-authored a report that found 60,000 people around the world die each year from air pollution from ships. That's because ships burn very dirty oil called bunker fuel. It has a high sulfur content.
That pollution gets turned into particulate matter, and particulate matter from these types of vessels are carcinogens, and they cause lung cancer, and they also cause heart disease.
And trigger asthma attacks and impede the development of children's lungs. Weinbrake says requiring ships to burn cleaner fuel near shore would make a big difference.
That will end up saving a lot of lives and will go a long way to improving the health of Americans and Canadians.
Charles Connor, president of the American Lung Association, says port pollution is much more harmful to Americans' health than most people realize.
It's especially bad on people, frankly, who live around the port cities.
He says while a lot of people were unaware of the pollution caused by shipping, it wasn't a surprise to him because he's a former Navy captain.
We in the Navy see lots of merchant ships, and my experience has been that they spew out all kinds of smoke.
Today's announcement came after a report by the EPA's Office of Inspector General criticized the agency for not doing enough to regulate pollution from ocean-going vessels. Although the EPA regulates one pollutant, nitrogen oxides, from U.S. flagged ships, 90% of ships that call on U.S. ports are foreign flagged, and they're not regulated at all. Joe Cox is the president of the Chamber of Shipping of America. He said international shipping companies recognize they have to address their exhausts, even though it will be expensive.
As we sat down at the table, we realized that we are part of the air pollution problem, and we're going to have to accept some requirements so that we're not a part of that problem.
The Bush administration laid the groundwork for today's announcement. It took the lead in negotiating the new international agreement that allows countries to require ships to slash pollution. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.